Test it. There we go. Today is Halacha Day on Perek Ches of Bereishis. And I looked through the Perek quickly. There wasn't much to comment on until he got to the very last pasuk. Now, those in my shul, we talked about this between Mincha Marav a couple of weeks ago, Parshas Noach. But we'll do it in the context of our Chumash here. And the very last pasuk says, Od kol yumei ha'aretz, that Hashem promises Noach, or Hashem actually doesn't promise Noach at that point, he's still thinking to himself that that the rest of the days of the land, Zera v'ketzir v'kor v'chom v'kayitz v'choref v'yom v'layla, that all of those are the six seasons, the Torah has six seasons, lo yishposu, they should not rest. So that is actually the pasuk that is quoted in the Gemara and Sanhedrin as prohibiting non-Jews from taking a rest, taking a day of rest for the Shabbos. Oh, I got my notes. Darn. All right, we should be okay. So, the Gemara Sanhedrin tells us that besides the Shabbat Mitzvah B'nai Noach, that I guess we'll learn about in the next parak, the B'nai Noach are also commanded on a few more. And one of those is the Asur Lishos B'Malachos B'Yom HaShabbos V'Yom Shabbos Chayiv Misa, that they're not allowed to rest from Malacha on the day of Shabbos, and if they do, they are Chayiv Misa. As we learn out from the pasuk, this pasuk that we mentioned just now, Yom V'Layla Lo Yishposu, that they should not rest for that day and night, they should not rest. Now, what is the reason for that? Right, that's a pretty significant prohibition. So, what is the reason for that? So, the Rashi on that Gemara comments that you don't want them resting. You don't want them taking the day off because they're supposed to be working. That's the job that non-Jews have, whatever that means. So the implication from that Rashi is that it doesn't necessarily even mean Shabbos. If non-Jews take Tuesdays off, or Thursdays off, or Sundays off, or Fridays off, right? That as well would be a violation of this din. The Rambam has a different take on the reason, on the svara behind this. The Rambam's take is because you don't want them kind of being involved, involved with dinim, that taking their religion and imposing parts of ours on theirs, or imposing their religion on ours, right? We don't want that kind of interconnection, and therefore they're going to have that prohibition upon them. As the Rambam says, Kol shel davar imanichin osu l'chadish das v'lasos mitzvos li'atzman. They're not supposed to be making mitzvos for themselves, midaitem, based on their own opinions. El oya ger tzedek v'yikabel kol mitzvos oyamim b'taras v'lo yusif v'lo yigur. Rather, they should either be a ger and they accept upon themselves all the mitzvos, or they keep their Torah and don't add and don't involve themselves with ours. There is a medrash as well that speaks to this and gives the reason that Shabbos is a special time between Jews and non-Jews, and having between Hashem and His people, and having non-Jews come in into the picture is a third wheel, right? And that's kind of getting involved. The private time gives this whole mushel of the king and the queen, and they're having their private time together, and having other people come in is not appropriate during that period. So fine, so that is the halacha. So that leads to an important question. So Rav Asher Weiss, in his essays on his shirim on Parsha Sishim Halacha in the Parsha, so he raises the following question, which is a famous question that has been going on for years and years and years, and that is, the Avos were Jewish, but yet, right, they didn't qualify as Jews yet. They didn't really become Jews until Matan Torah. But yet, we assume that they kept the entire Torah. The Gemara points out in a few places that they kept the entire Torah, even Erev Hafshilin, which implies all mitzvahs derabbanan, even rabbinic laws, they kept as well. So how could they keep all mitzvahs, including the mitzvah of Shabbos, but yet also not be Chayav Misa for resting on Shabbos? Right? That's the question. What did Avos do about the fact that non-Jews aren't allowed to keep Shabbos, but yet they kept the entire Torah, which implies that they kept the Shabbos, right? So there are, he quotes here seven answers that he brings down as to how to resolve that problem, right? So the first answer that he quotes is from the Baal Mulei, the Parshas Drachim, I don't know who that is, but he gives the following idea, that yes, it's true that they did malachos on they did malachos on Shabbos. So if they didn't do malachos on Shabbos, they would be chayv misa. They would be liable to the death penalty. But what was the reason that they did their malacha? Right. So what malacha did they do? Right. Take your pick. They plowed. Right. So why did they plow? What was the svar? What was the motivation for them plowing? No. To work on Shabbos, right? They had to violate the Shabbos, otherwise they wouldn't. Otherwise they would be killed. Right. So if you plow, let's say they plowed. If they plow and let's say a person today picks up dirt because they need to make a, they want to make a sandbag, but they pick up dirt because they like picking up dirt. If anyone can imagine such a thing, right? So you pick it up and you leave behind a furrow. Right, so have you violated the din d'oraisa of plowing on Shabbos? No. What do we call that? We call that a malacha she'in tzricha legufa. A malacha that was done, but not for the purpose of that malacha. Right, so that, another classic example of that is catching a bug. Right, so you catch a bug, that the real malacha is tzeda, is capturing for the purpose of killing. To capture a bug is capturing for the purpose of not bothering me anymore, right? So that is a malacha she'ena tzvicha legufa, right? It's the same concept. That's a malacha she'ena tzvicha legufa. It's a malacha that is done. It's the same action, but it's done not for the purpose of the malacha. So comes this the Sefer Darkit, the Parshas Drachim, and says, aha, so why is it that the Avos were doing malachos on Shabbos? Not because they wanted to do the malacha, but rather because they wanted to avoid the death penalty. Right? If that's the case, we call that a malacha she'ena tzricha legufa. That is what the Parshas Drachim claims. Right? Now, we can, if we think about that a little bit more, says, well, that actually, that's a big issue. Really? That's the case? That's what it means? So if that's the case, so one can make the case that they are never mechal, or not, they never, but a person could avoid being mechal shas by making the following svara. Why am I, so, well, he gives the following, so we know that for the first half of the 1900s, right, so many Jews, even Jews that are otherwise or otherwise Orthodox, had to go to work on Shabbos, because as the saying went, if you don't show up on Saturday, don't bother showing up on Monday, right? So many Jews worked. So they did, right? Whatever, you know, that those are the facts. So claims of Asher Weiss, according to that Svara, one could claim that why are they working? Why are they going and hemming pants or stamping buttons or whatever it is that they were doing, right? Why is it that they were doing that? Were they doing it because they wanted to stamp buttons or because they wanted to hem pants, which are all malachos d'oraisa? No, right? Why were they doing it?
To survive.
They wanted to make money. They wanted to keep their job on Monday. So their kavana wasn't the malacha itself, but rather their kavana was what a side point to it. So are you going to say that all of that is a malacha she'ena tzricha legufa? That's a very nice limud tzchus, but it probably halachically is incorrect. So that is idea number one. The second thing that Rav Asher Weiss points out, and we're going to have another two answers along these lines as well, is that a malacha she'ena tzricha legufa is still an iser derabanan, right? That you're not allowed to pick up dirt on Shabbos while leaving the furrow behind. We call that a malacha she'ena tzricha, we call that a malacha she'ena tzricha legufa, and those are prohibited on a level of derabanan. And what do we know about the avos? Right, they kept Isuri Durabanan, right? Presumably, right? They followed even rabbinic law. So how can you say that? So it doesn't work. Third of all, and the flip side of that is, if you're going to tell me, well, they only violated rabbinic law, so does violating rabbinic law accomplish the task of doing malacha on Shabbos? Right? Have they solved the problem? Right, by doing a right, if the Torah is telling us that non-Jews are not allowed to do not allowed to keep it as a day of rest, so does the Torah represent Torah recognize rabbinic law as being okay with that? Maybe yes, maybe no. It's unclear, right? But it hardly is a very fulfilling answer. Rav Asher Weiss quotes another two answers along those lines that are only issues on a level of derabanan. Is that the Avos might have done it with another person, may have done it with what we call Shnaim Shiyasu, two people do it together. So two people do a malacha together. Two people pull a plow together, right? So they have both violated the malacha on a level of derabanan, right? They didn't do the full malacha, so therefore it's only a rabbinic problem, it's not a deraisa problem. And he has a similar type is that they did malachos chatzishir. They went, they did half of the amount of a malacha. I'm not sure what he would be, what the case of that would be. But there you would be exempt from punishment, but you would have fulfilled this issue. But of course, those have shailas that go along with it. Fine. Those are three answers. He gives another answer here, which I find this one very interesting. Now, what is the pasuk that we just read? What did the pasuk say? When does one have to rest? Those last three words, or last four words. What do the words say? All right, the last words in Perek Ches of Bereishis are last four words. Yom v'layla lo yishbosu. Right? When does Shabbos start? Laila. Right? So our version of Shabbos is what? Laila v'yom, vayi erev, vayi boker. So Shabbos by us starts Friday night, or as the case may be this coming week, Friday early afternoon, right? And continues till, Saturday night, which this week is Saturday afternoon, right? What is Hashem telling them they're not allowed to do? Yom v'layla, day and night, they cannot do lo yishbosu. They can't do malacha, which is that the night is following the day. So it could be that from a non-Jewish perspective, a day is not night and day, but rather it's day and night. So as long as they do malacha on Motzei Shabbos, they're okay. Right? From a non-Jewish perspective, the prohibition is a day going into a night. So from our perspective, it's night and day. So our problem would be Friday night and Saturday. There it should be Saturday and Saturday night. So as long as you do malacha Saturday night, you avoid the problem. That's the suggestion that is brought down. But otherwise raises a kash on that as well by saying, well, wait a second. Vayera vayhi boker was the way of the creation of the world. That sounds like it should apply to everybody. Why should that only apply to Jews and not to non-Jews? Right, that is a kash. But I thought the suggestion is certainly an interesting one. Comes the Binyan Sion, gives one more suggestion, and he suggests that he's the one who raises the question on that suggestion. And then finally, I remember in an elementary school, I mentioned this in shul, I told this story, I remember being in 6th or 7th grade, I think 7th grade, our Rebbe asked us this question. Let's say you find out right before Shabbos that you're not Jewish, and you therefore need to do malacha over the course of Shabbos. You find out right before Shabbos that you may not be Jewish. Right? So you have a suffix whether you're Jewish. Right, so now you have all the Shabbos. If you're Jewish, then you're not allowed to do malacha. If you're not Jewish, then you have to do malacha. Right, so how do you solve that problem? So he gave us that as a riddle to work on over Shabbos. And the answer that the Rebbe gave is this answer that is probably the most famous answer, because it's suggested by the Maram Shik, quoting in the name of his Rebbe, the Chassam Sofer. And what is his suggestion? You should put on tzitzis and walk around outside an Erev. Right, because if you're Jewish, then you should be wearing tzitzis. If you're not Jewish, what are you doing wearing tzitzis, right? So it's just a masa, it's just a burden for you, and therefore you would be in violation of carrying outside the Eruv only if you're not Jewish. So I remember being in 7th grade having the same question that Richard is probably wondering about right now. Says, who says that that's true, right? Non-Jews that wear tzitzis, they're carrying it as a masa. There's plenty of non-Jews that probably wear tzitzis. And, those that are in the process of converting, so they're wearing tzitzis to get the mitzvah, right? That's not a mitzvah that they're chayiv misa for, right? So I remember having that question in 7th grade, and my Rebbe arguing back to me, saying, no, non-Jews. I don't know. My experience in the rabbin has certainly introduced me to plenty of non-Jews that are wearing tzitzis. I don't know. And besides, that wouldn't necessarily solve the problem for Avraham, because Avraham was wearing tzitzis. I mean, Avraham presumably was wearing tzitzis to fulfill the mitzvah. Right, so I have always had problems with that issue. So anyways, this is one of the famous riddles that are out there of if non-Jews are not permitted to keep the Shabbos, how did the Avos do it? Ultimately, Rav Asher Weiss in his essay points out, and this is my, when I've been involved with Geiris also, we don't generally encourage this. We don't generally tell not people that are on their way to conversion that they should be doing malacha every Shabbos, they should be doing an act of malacha every Shabbos. So why is that? Right? So probably the answer is, Rav Asher Weiss explains, that what is the reason for the prohibition? The reason for the prohibition is as the Rambam said, to quote the Rambam, the Rambam said, "Kol shel davar imanichin osel lachadish das v'lasos mitzvos liatzma." They can't pick and choose mitzvos that they're going to do for themselves. It's inappropriate for them to take this and impose it upon themselves. But if a person is on their way to conversion, why are they doing it? They're imposing it upon themselves? No, they're attempting to enter into Klal Yisrael. They're doing it not because they, oh, that's a good idea, I'm going to take it for me. They're doing it the same reason Jews are doing it, because Hashem commanded it, and it's something that is okay. So therefore the minhag seems to be, although there are those certainly that do this, I think the minhag seems to be that people don't impose this upon the people that are converting. From my perspective, Hilchos Shabbos is so complicated, they're probably violating something anyways. Well, that's the cynical view. So to ask them to violate more is I don't think, is generally done. Okay? So on that note, we'll go back to the year 1848. So there is Rabbi J. David Bleich. If anybody is a massive Talmud Chacham, he's the head of the Yadin Kolel at YU, meaning the Dayanus, the judge to train judges. He's also a trained lawyer. I'm not sure if trained lawyer or not, but gives classes in law school as well and writes prolifically. And when I mean prolifically, I mean, you know, prolific, prolifically. He is for years and years and years put together an article in every issue of Tradition. At least, maybe there are a few exceptions. Tradition is, which is now for, you know, 30, 40 years, where he takes, and it comes out four times a year, where he takes a topic that is kind of out there and investigates it fully. And he published them in books as well, Contemporary Halach Problems. There's five, I have up to volume four, there's a fifth volume out as well. If anybody is interested in, you know, reading, you know, classic halachic texts, you know, classic halachic responsa type text, but has difficulty working themselves their way through the Hebrew, so this is a text to use. I mean, it is dense and thick and all of that. So he has an issue of where he points out that sometimes a case happens that is very rare, but wakes up the whole halachic world, and everybody starts arguing about a specific case. And this is the case that he, and this is an example. That in the year 1848, there was a fellow from Morocco who underwent a conversion in Yerushalayim. So he makes his way to Yerushalayim, he converts there, and there, as we probably know, there's two main stages for a conversion, Bizman Hazeh, for a man, and that is that A, he has to have a bris, and B, he has to go to the mikvah. And then obviously there's Kabbalah HaMitzvos that goes along with it. But those are the stages, right? So generally today, where most males are circumcised, right? So it happens within 20 minutes of each other, right? The guy, you give a tiny, tiny prick, let a little bit of blood out, it really doesn't hurt at all. It's really not a big, not that I've ever gone through it, but I've been present for when it's been gone through. It's really not a very big, it's like a paper cut. Less painful than a paper cut. Just let a little bit of blood out, and then, you know, it heals, and then 5 minutes later they go into the mikvah. It happens at the same time. However, it does happen today sometimes, and it certainly happened 150 years ago, that they actually needed a bris. They needed a full-fledged circumcision as part of the process in terms of becoming a ger. This happens today. I had a member of mine in Phoenix that did this, went through a full-fledged circumcision. Off tape, we can tell you a little bit more about it. But anyways, it happened. It happens today, but it happened more regularly then. So this fellow became a convert on Wednesday or something, and was supposed to go to the mikveh, but he developed some kind of infection from the bris. So he had to hold off on going to the mikveh for a little bit. So all of a sudden, it comes. So he wasn't feeling well on Shabbos. But this was his first Shabbos as being a quasi-Jew, right? He's between Mila and Tevila. So what is he at that point? So we would probably assume he's not Jewish, but he achieved something. And he, to the point that he wasn't feeling well, somebody wanted to come and light a fire for him or something in his house to warm him up. A non-Jew wanted to light a fire to warm him up, and he refused even to have the non-Jew do any work for him. This is my first Shabbos. I'm not messing it up with any Amir Lakum or anything like that. You know, we're not going there. So his friends was concerned. So what do? So you go to the rabbi's house and tell the rabbi, you know, this guy, he's converted and he's not feeling well. We really should have a non-Jew light a fire for him, and he's refusing, right? So they go to the rabbi's house, and right, Rabbi Shmuel Salant is the chief rabbi of Yerushalayim at the time. And Rabbi Shmuel Salant is away on business. He he's away. He's traveled to Europe in order to raise funds for the yeshuv. So instead of going to Rav Salant's house, so they have to go to the assistant rabbi, or the Av Basin, Rav Asher Lemel. Rav Asher Lemel is not as well known as Rav Shmuel Salant, right? So they knock on Rav Asher Lemel's door and they tell him the problem. You know, this person, you know, maybe if you would go and tell him that a non-Jew should do work on your behalf, right? So he would listen to you and he'd allow the fire to be lit. He's really suffering, he's really in pain. So what does Rav Asher Lemel respond? He says, what do you mean he should have a non-Jew do it on his behalf? He should do it himself on his behalf! Right, he's not Jewish, and therefore ger sheshavas chayiv misa. A non-Jew who keeps the Shabbos is liable for the death penalty. He better do malacha fast, otherwise he's violated this halacha from the pasuk in Parshas Noach. Right, that is so. What happens? So Rav Asher Lemel, he's the rav of the town. He might be the assistant rabbi, but that Shabbos he's in charge. Right, and he prevails upon him that he needs to write two letters. That he writes to, what how does the story go? Here, Rav Asher Lemel's ruling. The convert who apparently had been scrupulous and observant. So as the story continues, that they go to the convert, this halfway convert's house, and they go to his house and tell him, you know, the Rebbe said, not just should you have the non-Jew do malacha for you, you have to do malacha for yourself. So his response is, why? Well, you're not Jewish. Says, well, I haven't been Jewish for the last 6 months, and I haven't done malach on any of those Shabbosim, right? Nobody ever told him about this halacha before, right? But meanwhile, the Rav comes to his house and complied with the directive, but tears filled his eyes at being compelled to violate the Sabbath. And confined with Rav Asher Lemel's directive, he wrote several letters on a piece of paper, or according to another version of his story, he signed his name in the vernacular, meaning he violated a malach on Shabbos. And everything went from, and then after Shabbos is over and the Pesach gets back to Europe and Rishul Zant hears about this, all, you know, proverbial, right. Everything, everybody goes wild over this, right? Isn't, so there's two Shilas, right? Shila number A is Lamaisa. If he's not Jewish, does he need to violate the Malacha Doraisa? And second of all, even if the answer to that is yes, he's quasi-Jewish already, right? He's a ger shemal velo tavel, so maybe he should not have to do malach, even if you hold that all non-Jews would have to. So that is the. It goes on for a few pages. You can find this online. The book online, the article is available online as well from the article in Tradition. But the Rav Yaakov Ettlinger, who was very much involved with this, Machlok Yaakov Ettlinger was the Rav in Germany at the time. He was the Rebbe of Rav Samson Raphael Hirsch, Rav Yaakov Ettlinger, also the author of the Aruch Haner. So Rav Yaakov Ettlinger, a fine Jew, so he explains as follows. He says, well, are you going to tell me that Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov really are not Jewish at all? Like, what do you mean they're not? They might not be B'nai Yisrael, but he was Yisrael, right? Yaakov was Yisrael. How can you say they're not Jewish at all? So he makes the following distinction, that it could be that there's two different stages. There's leaving the stage of being non-Jewish and entering the stage of being Jewish. So it could be they have not entered the stage of being part of Klal Yisrael, part of B'nai Yisrael, but you no longer could say that they're non-Jewish anymore either. Right? So he claims that has to do with the bris, that the bris gets you at me. So Avram had a bris. Right? Why do you have a bris? Right? So Avram bris probably removes him. The bris removes him from being non-Jewish, but doesn't yet necessarily give him full credit as being part of Klal Yisrael. But that would exempt him from the issue of ger about a non-Jew being chayiv misa. I mean, he's no longer a non-Jew for that problem. Now, it doesn't solve the problem of today, but probably rely on Rav Asher Weiss to solve the problem of today. This svara, I'll give one other. How are we doing here? We'll give one other time when this svara has popped up, at least in my rabbinate, that this idea that while a person may not be Jewish yet, they're already considered part of our nation, and that is the complicated issue around Yontif time, about inviting people that are in the process of conversion, inviting them for Yontif meals. There is a prohibition in inviting non-Jews for meals on Yontif, because you are only permitted to cook on behalf of Jews, you're not allowed to cook on behalf of non-Jews. Right? So if you're going to have a non-Jews over, you may shema yarba bishvilo. You may increase, you may make more food on yontif on their behalf. So on the books, there's a prohibition in having non-Jews over for meals on yontif. This obviously leads to some issues, right? One of those issues is this, somebody in the process of conversion. So you're going to tell them, sorry, you can't come to a seder, you can't eat in a sukkah, you can't do anything. So, but this is a real significant challenge. So I remember, there's several different types of itzos that are out there. I remember speaking once to Rav Gedalia Dov Schwartz on this issue. He has told it to many people. I assume there's no issue with me putting it on tape. He claims this svara. He claims that there is a tshuva from the Minchas Eluzer. Minchas Eluzer was the Munkacher Rav, the Munkacher Rebbe, there where he has a shaila about burial in a Jewish cemetery, that the person had also a ger shemovelo tavol, they had their bris, and they hadn't yet done tefillah, or maybe it was a girl, I don't remember, maybe there wasn't even, I don't, excuse me, may not have had mila yet, I don't remember, but like on the way to do conversion, they got in a car, not a car accident, but they died on the way to conversion, I mean, they were about to do it, but they never actually got the chance to do the actual conversion. So the shaila was, are you allowed to bury her in the Jewish cemetery? Right, that was the shaila. Right, and you realize there's a problem both ways. You say that she could be buried in the Jewish cemetery, so then you have a question of, is that really okay? If you say bury her in the non-Jewish cemetery, so you could be burying somebody who's partially Jewish in a non-Jewish cemetery, right? That's an issue as well. So he suggests this. He suggests that, well, she may have left the category of Akum, and therefore is close enough within our circles that she could be buried in a Jewish cemetery. That's his suggestion, although that wasn't actually the Shaila, whatever. He says that in a kind of a hypothetical case. He doesn't actually paskin at Lemaisa. So Rav Gedalia Dov Schwartz, the Av Basin in Chicago, wants to apply that idea here as well. That the prohibition is to cook for people that you have no responsibility for. Meaning one is permitted to cook on Yontif if you have a housekeeper. So in theory, you're allowed to cook for them on yontif. If that's your setup, right? So you're responsible for their food, right? You're responsible. Right? There's no prohibition that you're not allowed to feed animals on Shabbat. You're not allowed to feed animals that you're responsible for on yontif because you may cook more for them, right? If you're responsible, you're responsible. So if this person is already a significantly part of the Jewish people, so we have a responsibility for them. Right? And therefore, one would be permitted to have them over for yontif meals. That was his eitzah, his heter. There are other heterim out there as well. There's other ways to work that out. If one is actually that shaila actually shows up, lemaisa suggests you ask your lord, your local Orthodox rabbinic
deity.
Yeah, I don't know. That's one of my students in TI used to when I would say that, whatever. But that is the issue. Yes.
You're permitted to cook more on yontif because maybe guests will show up.
Right.
We learned this with you.
Yes.
Once upon a time.
Yes.
So, does it qualify if you've done that because guests might show up? Does that restrict the category of guests you can feed with the food that you didn't specifically make for them?
Yeah. So the answer is no. It still is a problem because it's a gezeira. I mean, the gezeira is not, you're not allowed to cook more food for them. That is a din, right? That would be an issur d'oraisa, right? So the gezeira is, we shouldn't feed non, this is the way it's structured, we shouldn't feed non-Jews lest I go and cook more for them, right? So therefore, even if you have more food for them, it's going to be problematic. The one suggestion that I saw out there is, I think from Rav Shlomo Zalman, although someone told me that there's no way Rosh Hashanah Zalman actually meant this. He meant this as a joke. But one can take a neder that I'm not going to cook on behalf of the non-Jew. If you take a neder, so then you have excluded yourself from the possibility of doing it. I wouldn't do that. I don't think it's a good idea to take the darim at all, bizman hazeh. Certainly not under those circumstances. But just saying, oh, well, I have extra food around, that is the gezeira. The gezeira is, when you have extra food around, you're still not allowed to give them the food.
Okay, the gezeira is worded which way?
That I'm not allowed to have non-Jews over to eat the food that I already have.
Because I might make extra food.
Right.
If you already made the extra food.
No, but then there's no gezeira. I mean right. if by having them over, I am going to cook extra food, that's not a gezeira, that's an isser d'oraisa.
Okay.
right? So the gezeirah is only if I wouldn't necessarily be cooking them extra food, and yet I have them over anyways. Yeah.
So spontaneously, to invite a guest over.
Yeah, so that's one of the heterim possibly, that if you invite them but don't tell your wife. I'm serious. That like, or one of them shows up without being invited, or you kind of say like, you know, you show up at 1 o'clock, so you know, I won't say anything. You're like, right? So that might be one of the ways around the heter. Yeah. Yeah, but it's a challenge. It's a significant challenge, especially certainly within families as well. I mean, sometimes they have an intermarriage person or something like that in the family, right? This is I've dealt with in my career. These are challenging issues to resolve. Okay, Yashukaya, let's start.